Good evening. Thank you very much for coming here. It's a pleasure to be here. I am a rotten timekeeper, so you are allowed to give me like a countdown towards the end, because I wanted to talk here tonight about the Henry that I saw when I was writing the novel The Constant Princess, when he's not even yet a prince. He's the spare. There's the heir, who is Arthur, and he's the one that everybody's interested in, who's going to be Prince of Wales, who's going to marry Catherine of Spain, who's going to inherit the Tudor throne, who is going to be a king forever. And then there is a spare that actually they're going to pop into the church. Basically, his function is going to be, and we do know what young royal princes are like when they know they're the spare, his function is going to be to wait in case he's needed. And of course, tragically, he was needed. But of course, he didn't know that. When he was being brought up through his life, his primary influences in his life was possibly, we don't even know because we're not very clear about how effective his mother was able to be, but Elizabeth, Princess of York, a daughter of the Plantagenets, the ruling family before the Tudors, and therefore in one way a constant reminder to the Tudors that their throne was newly established and not necessarily secure. Even before he was born, there had been pretenders, a series of pretenders actually, arriving claiming to be other Plantagenet heirs. And so Henry VII's rule of England and his confidence in his holding of England was always insecure. Indeed, Catherine of Aragon perhaps would not have been allowed to come to England until the bloodline was secured by the murder of the last Warwick, the Earl of Warwick, the last York heir in the Tower. So what you have here is a family that's quite insecure about their establishment. And what you have here is a young boy who is, in a sense, I think, protected from a lot of this anxiety, but who nonetheless lives in a newly established family, in a newly established reign. We have the picture of Thomas More and Erasmus going to visit the royal nursery and being so impressed with Henry, who's he sounds like a darling. He's a sporty little boy, he's golden-haired, he's very, very good at music, he loves his art, he's been very well taught. He's being probably prepared for the church in the absence of anything else. Can you imagine if Arthur had lived and Henry had been Pope? And don't you know, he would have been one of the most demanding, tyrannical papal popes that, you know, Europe had ever had. But he was a very, clearly then, he was a very spirited boy. He was a boy adored, without a doubt, by his mother Elizabeth, and without a doubt by his very strict, religious, demanding, authoritative grandmother, Margaret of Beaufort, who did draw up the rules of the household which said how he and everything else should happen. I'm a novelist. I'm a historian by training, but I'm a novelist by trade. You will probably know that. And sometimes I have to go on tour and talk about the creation of character. So in that sense, I don't have my historian's hat on, I have my novelist hat on. And one of the absolute rules which I impose on myself is, firstly, never, never, never to talk about my children because they hate it so much. And secondly, never to get too kind of sentimental about these characters. And my daughter, who is 10 years older than my son, this occurred when she was 20 and my son was 10, and I was writing about Henry, who himself was 10. My daughter said to me, she read The Constant Princess, and she said to me, "You don't ever draw on us for your novels, do you?" "No," I said, lying with the instantaneous speed of a good mother. "Not at all, I wouldn't do so. I'd do it based entirely on historical research, and then I create the characters on the basis of that." "Yes," she said. She read The Constant Princess. In it is this boy adored by his mother. Blonde, handsome, strong, sporty, musical, gifted. She said to me, "It's Adam, isn't it?" And I'd say, "Yes, it is Adam, and I think he's as wonderful as that." So I have a great affection for Henry because I know he turns into a tyrant. Please God, Adam does not experience the years that we know are coming to Henry and indeed becomes a wife murderer. Let us hope we're spared that. But when you see this boy at 10, you see a young Englishman with, you know, everything, you know, a family that's becoming established, a royal court that's forming and growing in confidence, you know, a mother who comes to him from the Plantagenets, a grandmother of such learning and education and rigor, and a father who is determined to make their place in England and who is a good and just king, clearly in the early years of his life, a very fair king. So you have this boy who's just filled with potential, and then he has, in his childhood also, a terrible year. In 1502, his handsome, strong elder brother dies in Wales, and the news is brought to court, and his father collapses in grief and his mother collapses in grief, and you can just imagine the whole court's horror at what this has happened. And Henry is only 10. When he's 11, his mother dies in childbirth, trying to get another Tudor boy into the cradle. We can't know, and in some ways it's terribly modern and very vulgarly psychological to transpeculate what that means. It doesn't mean to a Tudor boy what it would mean to a modern boy. We can be sure of that. They don't have any sense of the psychology of the primacy of the maternal bond. They haven't read anything about it. They don't know anything about Freud. God bless them. They haven't got an unconsciousness. What a relief that must have been for them. So they, of course, I mean, they have one, but they don't think about it all the damn time, which must have been nice for them and frustrating for us, because we don't have that kind of personal diary material that we could draw on. But we can assume that even though there is nobody around him saying, "You are so traumatized, my child, I'm going to send you to a grief counselor," there would have been a terrible impact on this boy who had expected to live a life of privilege and comfort and relaxed pleasure with a career laid out before him, supported by his parents. And then he finds very, very quickly, firstly, that the burden of being king, plus the power and the opportunity, but the terrible burden of being the heir had descended to him, and then the year after that, his mother isn't even there to guide him anymore. To me, I think that's one of the moments where Henry's life changes so dramatically for the worse that one can see that what comes out of that is a young man who is looking for security and for looking for people he can count on. He's very lucky in that later in his life he marries Catherine of Aragon, who was a woman he could count on. And he's very unlucky that he doesn't choose to count on her and stay with her, in my opinion. He depends on Cardinal Wolsey, he moves on to Anne Boleyn. But I think we do see through his life the sort of seeking for emotional comfort and for emotional security, and sometimes, of course, simply for power and the brutish exercise of a tyranny. But sometimes I think we can look at the adult Henry with some sympathy and see in him the boy who was so tragically damaged, and he wasn't even more than 11. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Philippa. You set a very high standard in terms of timekeeping as well
as
eloquence there. So,